The truth is that I did mess up my life. I did make some big mistakes. I have been living in sin. Let's not run from that. Let's admit that I messed up, right? And let's admit that whatever I'm doing, my approach is not working. And I tried everything. I tried all these like different modalities, psychedelics, practitioners. I'd spent 20 grand on all this money trying to get out of my pain, chiropractors, IMS, all the things, right? Massage therapy, physio, nothing even touched it. Nothing would even remotely remove any pain. So I was desperate. So I decide to try something radically different, something I had never tried, the last place I ever expected to look. I just decided to start praying every single day.
Hey guys, welcome back to Throwing Mountains, where men are rediscovering courageous leadership. My name is Mike Hatch. I am your host. And of course, I'll be joined shortly with my co-host, Chris Bollinger. Now, today we are interviewing a kind of a newer friend of mine named Cody Thompson. I met Cody in a Bitcoin community, and that may not be a surprise to some of you who've been listening to the show for a while and know that I'm a Bitcoin advocate. Cody has been a TikTok influencer for a while since he came to faith in Christ. He's got an amazing story that you're going to hear about. His mission is to influence other men to be able to take responsibility for themselves, have a little bit more self-sovereignty, as he describes, and in order to make a difference for the kingdom of God. And he and his wife personally try to be very self-sufficient by growing some of their own food, for example, staying physically healthy, and accepting responsibility for their own financial future. In this interview, Cody will share his story. He'll share more about what it means to be a self-sovereign man. I think you're going to be really encouraged by God's faithfulness as it has shown up in Cody and his wife and their family's life, as well as how God could do some amazing things in your life. All right, so let's go ahead and dive into the interview. Here is our interview with Cody Thompson. Cody Thompson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a blessing to be here. Really grateful.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm grateful too. And we have so many intersections of shared passions and mission that I'm hoping we'll get to talk through. Because, man, I feel like you are just kind of a kindred spirit. I feel like we've got a lot of similar interests and God's doing similar things in our lives and showing us similar things about what's going on in today's culture. I think our listeners are going to get a ton of value from this. But before we jump into some of those topics, as we do with every episode, we want to hear your fence post story. And for those who are listening for the first time, let me give you a real brief overview of what that means. If you just imagine a fence that sits along a property and you've got those horizontal pieces, but they're held up by the vertical pieces that are driven into the ground that stabilize the whole thing. And those represent those significant moments in our lives or people in our lives that make us who we are today. So Cody, as you think about those significant moments in your life that led you to who you are today, your fence posts, we'd love to hear about some of them and learn a little bit more about you.
Sure. I grew up with an absent father. My biological father, my mom left him when I was about one. He was addicted and abusive and whatever. So my mom just left him, and she met a pretty good man when I was three, married him, but he worked away all the time. So he was an absent stepfather, never really in my life. So I really was lacking that masculine leadership, and I never really knew how to be a man. And it was mostly just me and my mom and my half brother. When I was 16, they divorced. And so all of a sudden I had no male role model in my life. And I kind of saw that as a free ticket to start rebelling. Like, I'm going to do whatever I want. And my mom had met a new man and they were going to move cities, which meant she wanted me to move with them. And I didn't want to move. I didn't want to relocate. So I decided, oh, that's a great idea. I'm just going to move out. I had just turned 17 and I decided to move out on my own. And that was very interesting. So started living on my own, still trying to go to high school, trying to make rent and all that. I didn't have any money. And it's like, how do I go to high school and come up with enough money for rent? So I started selling a bit of pot on the side, trying to make ends meet and doing whatever I had to do to make rent and all that. So
that's a very lucrative business.
It wasn't very lucrative, but it was just enough
really?
To make. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It wasn't lucrative at the time, selling a joint here or there, but that's how I was making ends meet. And that led to meeting some kind of different people, and then was introduced to psychedelics. So it started with mushrooms and led to things like ecstasy and later LSD and all that. So I started pretty young experimenting with psychedelics. And then I found that just fascinating. It was a whole new world. It was exciting to me. And I was very bored in school. I was always in trouble throughout all of school, all of elementary, all of high school. I just couldn't really keep my attention. And I was bored. So this was exciting. And I ended up actually dropping out of school and spending a lot of time just with psychedelics and partying, and started getting in trouble with the law a bit and all kinds of stuff. Just really got off course for a while there. And the drug use became an addiction. And then I started using drugs daily. And that became my main focus. And all of a sudden, all my friends were drug users. And just lost all of the friends that I had at one point. Like, they all left my life and I had a whole new group of friends that were in line with where my values were at the time. And that just really got a hold of me, and I was blinded by that. And this weird thing happened like a couple of years into the heavy drug use where I thought I was trying to solve a puzzle. I'd take psychedelics and then I'd get these little clues. I would listen to conversations and glean this different information out of it than what was actually being said. And I'd go to parties and I'd listen to just the whole group of people talking and see little bits that would come to me, and I'd formulate sentences out of it. It was like a way that God was speaking to me. It was a very odd thing. And at the time,
Hold on. I'm sorry. I want to stop you for just a second. So would you say you were introduced to God or faith? Did you have some knowledge of God in terms of faith, and maybe not Christianity, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, so my grandparents were Lutheran, and I did go to church the odd time growing up. It never really resonated with me. It was a lot of old people. There weren't really many young people at that church, and it was just kind of boring and hard to sit through. And so I had a hard time with church. I always did believe in God, though. I just had a hard time with the form of Christianity that I was introduced to. So I never really picked up the gospel or made it a habit to go to church. And then my stepfather was an atheist, and my mom was a very loose Christian.
God is beginning to reach out to you through these psychedelics.
Sure, but I didn't, at the time, I didn't see it as God. I was just thinking I was trying to solve this puzzle. And then there was one side of me going, I think you're actually just going insane. There's no way there's like a puzzle to solve. But then another side of me was telling me, no, there's something to solve. Keep seeking. You have to get this puzzle. So I did. I kept seeking and all along just wondering if I might be going insane. And then one day I took some psychedelics and I actually got the last piece to the puzzle. And it was the most profound thing that had ever happened to me up until that point, because I got that little clue and I put it in, and all of a sudden the puzzle was complete and I saw the big picture, and it was all like, wow, here it is. And all along, what it was is that I was a drug addict. And that last piece showed me the picture, and it was like, you're addicted to drugs. And I had no idea that I even had a problem. Even though I was taking drugs daily, I just thought, this is what I want to do. This is what I enjoy doing. So when I put that last piece in and realized, oh, I actually have a problem, and that's why my life's starting to fall apart. I'd been in trouble with the law. I dropped out of school. Like, just my life was totally falling apart. And then I saw this puzzle being completed. And so at that point, I made up my mind. I said, that's it. I'm going completely sober. So I went from taking drugs daily, smoking a pack of cigarettes daily, using marijuana, psychedelics, all this stuff, to just going fully sober. I had one relapse after making that decision, and that just even further strengthened my conviction to sobriety. And so I was 20 years old at the time and made that commitment to myself that I would not use psychedelics. I would go completely sober. I went vegetarian. I just radically shifted things up. And I was all excited about this. And I would see my biological father once or twice a year, often at Christmas time. He would come up. He lived in another province. So he would come over and I'd see him at my grandparents' place. And the second last time I saw him, he was so excited because he had always struggled with drug addiction. And so he told me,
Wow.
I've been in and out of rehab. I've been to, like, I think he said like 10 different rehab centers, and every time he got out, it would actually get worse. So it never worked for him. Mm. And then he told me this time he had done it on his own accord and he had been clean 3 months, and he said he'd never felt better. It was the first time I actually felt like I was connecting with my real biological father, and because he was sober, and it was like, wow, I'm actually connecting with him. I felt his love. He gave me a hug. Like, it was one of the only times I was ever hugged by a man, because my stepfather wasn't affectionate. And it melted my heart, and I was so excited. And he said, why don't we get a place together and we'll just get to know each other? And so I was so excited about this idea, and I was all lit up. And then he went back to his home, and I didn't hear from him for a bit. Mm. And then I got the call from my mother, and she says, oh, I've got some bad news for you. And right away, my heart sinks when you hear that, and I'm thinking, oh, great, grandma or grandpa died, right? And she goes, it's your father. He's committed suicide. They found him on the front steps of an abandoned church. Very symbolic. He had injected 6 times the lethal dose of heroin. So they ruled it a suicide, because even an addict knows you can't inject that much heroin without dying. So that just hit really hard, and I fell into a deep, deep depression, and I realized I was never going to get to know my father. That was just really, really tough for me. It crippled me. At the same time, it strengthened my conviction to sobriety. And I saw where that path could lead, and often does lead. So I stuck with the sobriety, and I just really all of a sudden felt like, wow, I've been wasting my time with 3 years of drug addiction. I need to get my life on track here. So I got a good job. I started an apprenticeship as an electrician, and I did 1 year of college, but then decided it wasn't for me. I didn't want to get into a bunch of debt. So I went into trades, and I decided.
No shame in that.
No. At the time there was, though. We were brainwashed for thinking, like, if you're going to do trades, you're going to be poor. That's what they told us. That's just for people that aren't very educated, who don't have the capacity to go to college or university. Yeah. So I had to let go of the teachings that I'd been told. And so I went into that, and because I was going into trades and I was told I would be poor if I did that, I also started studying money at the same time and learning about money and that. And I decided the way I would go about this is I would buy a house and I would start building capital. So I bought a house at 22 years old. I'd saved about $5,000. I borrowed $5,000 from my folks. I came up with a down payment, did that, and really got my life on track. And things, I was starting to come out of the depression about a year or two after my father's suicide, and life was feeling good. I'd met a woman. I had a girlfriend. She was living with me. So there was a suite in my house. So part of the way I was financing this is I'd rent out the suite. And so I was renting it to a couple of my friends. And my friend was in construction. He had his own company. He also struggled with addiction, and he had decided to quit alcohol, but he was still using marijuana. And then one day he started drinking again, and things started going south very quickly for him. And he's living with me, so I'm witnessing this, and I'm just seeing, I'm like, this is not good. And then he met with me, and he said, you know what? I've never told you this, but I've been suicidal my whole life. I've actually tried to commit suicide once before at your house, and I didn't know this. I didn't know he was suicidal. This was all news to me. And it just broke my heart, and I'm thinking, how can I encourage my brother? How can I lift him up? How can I help him out? And then he came home one day, and I found out that he had drank a whole bunch of beer on the job site. When he was leaving, he crashed into 3 vehicles and totaled his truck, totaled a bunch of vehicles. And for him, he thought this meant his whole life was over, because A, he was going to lose his business, he was going to lose face, and he couldn't deal with the shame. And so he was just in a very, very dark place. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him and trying to lift him out of that. And actually, let me back up before that happened. So a friend had told me what had happened, the other fellow who was living with us. So I was aware that this accident had happened, and I'm waiting for him to get home so I can talk to him about that. I heard him pull up. I heard him get his dog. I heard him go outside. And then I'm like, okay, I got to go outside and talk to him. So I went outside and he wasn't there. Mm. And the dog ran up and was barking frantically at me. And then ran to my detached garage and barked at the garage, and then did it again, ran back and barked at me. And I'm thinking, is this dog trying to tell me something? Like, Very, wow. Very odd. But I had this strong intuition that the dog was trying to tell me something. And I'm like, okay, I better go to the garage and just see. I might be crazy, but let me go check. So I was going to go get my shoes because the grass was wet. And then the dog was like so frantic that I just decided to run across the wet grass in my socks. And I opened the door of the garage. Right when I did that, my friend dropped into a noose and
hanging
from an extension cord.
Oh my gosh.
So I ran up and I bear hugged him, and he's struggling and kicking and yelling at me. And I'm trying to lift him up while I untie the knot with the other hand. And I managed to get him out of the noose and prevented him from hanging himself. And then we went through this whole 2 hours of just trying to get him out of this dark place. And I called his parents and wow. he locked himself in the room and all this. And he eventually came out. I thought things were under control. Then he got a phone call. I was 2 hours late for a fishing trip. I was supposed to be hitting the road. So in the back of my mind, I'm just selfish me is thinking like, oh, I got to get on the road. So I told another friend that was there what had happened. I said, can you look after him? We need somebody by his side until his parents get here. And he said, sure, sure. So I thought it was under control. The phone rang. The fellow thought it was his parents. So I thought everything was handled. And I said, okay, John, like, I'll see you later. I got to head out on this fishing trip. And I left for the weekend and I went on the fishing trip. The whole time I tried to call him. I tried to text, no response. So I got back after the weekend and I called his parents and I just had asked if they had heard from him. They hadn't. So I told them what had happened on the Friday and they weren't aware of it. And so they were very concerned, obviously. And they said, call us if you hear of anything. And then another friend stopped by, told him the story, and he said, well, we have to go check the garage. And I just thought, no, there's no way. There's no way. Some part of me thought it was an attention grab. And so I really doubted it, but we decided to go check the garage and on the door. And sure enough, there he was hanging and he had killed himself. And it was only four years after my father's suicide. So it just sucked me right back into that very dark, depressed place. And I didn't have faith. I didn't have a father. I didn't have any good friends. And so I went through this alone. And that was the time I didn't know the Lord yet very well. But that was when I met the devil. And I remember I dropped to my knees and I was grabbing my skin and I was trying to rip it off because I wanted to be dreaming. It was terrible. Right when we found the body, the father showed up. So we told him immediately. Right when we told him, his phone was ringing while we were telling him and he answered. So he heard the news before he even responded. It was his wife on the phone. So his first response was he told his wife over the phone that their son had killed himself. So they rushed down, the daughter and the mom, and there was all the screaming. Anyways, it was horrible. And I felt the presence of Satan very, very clearly. Satan was there and I knew it. So that was my first encounter with Satan that was undeniable. Wow. He was there. And so I sold the house. I had to move on. I had to get out of there. So I went to the big city, continued, finished my apprenticeship. I got a job. I just tried to leave that behind me. And then things were going along. I got into rock climbing. That was kind of the way that I dealt with all of this. It was my vent. I would just go and climb hard and train. And it was a way that it took my mind off all the pain I was suffering. I also had experienced some chronic pain. I herniated my disc in a skateboarding accident the year my father had committed suicide. And so I was dealing with this chronic pain, working in trades, always wearing a tool belt. It was really hard, but I had bought that house. So I had to keep working. So I worked through this pain always. And there was no way that I could stop because I had mortgage payments. So anyways, fast forward 7 years, I'm about 27 years old. I'm climbing a lot. Life's pretty good, but I'm suffering still deep down with the pain, physical and emotional pain, and trying to bury it, trying to forget it, didn't know how to approach it or deal with it. And the climbing gym was closed one day and a friend said, hey, why don't we go to this gymnasium? They have like trampolines and it's like a proper gymnasium where you can train and there's mats. And so I said, sure. And he convinces me to try a backflip. I expressed my hesitancy because I had tried bad backflips in the past and I wasn't able to do it, but he just was like adamant that I try this backflip. So I started bouncing and he told me how to do it. And I tried and only rotated halfway and I came down and landed right on my head and it snapped my neck and pushed my face into my chest. And I fully severed all the ligaments and completely broke my neck and landed on the concrete floor and everyone rushed up and It was out at a university where this gymnasium was, and no one called for help. And I was just in unbearable pain. I knew something major had happened because the pain levels were just out of this world. The one fellow.
Nobody called 911?
No one called 911. And I'm sitting there wishing somebody would, but for some reason, I don't know what it was, but I didn't want to ask for help. So I just thought, well, if no one's going to call 911, I guess I'm okay. I'm going to have to approach this on my own. And the one fellow at the gymnasium running the gymnasium says, well, if you want to get it checked out, the hospital out here is closing in 15 minutes. So you might want to get up and get over there. And I'm like, oh man, I guess I got to get up here. So I had this inclination that something was wrong with my neck. So I grabbed it and I held it really still and I got up. And I walked myself over, I put my shoes on, I got a friend to drive me over to the hospital, and I walked in, I told the lady the story, and she was like, oh my gosh, do not move, stay right there. And she came around from the window, put a neck brace on me, they did the scans. One fellow thought I had just the compression fracture, so the vertebrae had compressed and a big chunk came off, and they saw that in the x-ray, and he's like, you're going to be in a halo for a year and a half, but
it's
broken, but we're going to send this off to a specialist to confirm. You can drive home tonight. Just be
very careful,
keep the neck brace on. So I drive home, and I'm, you know, drive myself home. I spend the night at home in all this pain, get a call the next day. They say, oh, the specialist has had a chance to look at it. It's actually much worse. All your ligaments appear to be severed. We need you to go back in. So I go back in. I'm stuck in the hallway of emergency with all these drug addicts and all this like crazy stuff going on. And they don't have a bed for me. Canada Healthcare at its finest.
Here we go.
It's free, but they pay really high taxes. So anyways, they finally get me a room and all this, and they decide they have to do surgery. So I'm like, are you sure? There's no other way around it. And they basically say, no, you have to have surgery. We have to drill through the vertebrae and fuse it with metal rods and pins. And so I go through the surgery, and I kept being told by every nurse who walked into my room, you know, you're not paralyzed. You're walking. Do you realize this is a miracle? Like you should be paralyzed. Almost no one walks away from this break. And I'm thinking, no, I'm just not supposed to be paralyzed. I had it made up in my mind that no, I'm not supposed to be paralyzed. And I was just convicted of this belief. I go through it. I spend the night there. The next day they come, they get me up. They try to get me to walk a flight of stairs. I pass out from the pain. They put me back in bed. I spend one more night. They come the next day. I was able to make a flight of stairs barely in so much pain, but I did it. So they discharge me. And so I can't walk. I'm in excruciating pain. I had to roll over and pee in this bottle. And if I had to use the washroom for any reason, I'd have to take a bunch of synthetic morphine, whatever they were giving me.
Right.
At the time, they were giving me the most amount they could legally give me because the pain couldn't get under control. So anyways, I moved back to my mother's house because I had no other option. I spend 3 months in bed, can't get out, and start using these synthetic painkillers. And so whatever, kind of like heal up, went a little stir crazy. And then I decide to go to a music festival because I was so bored at just being at home. There was like no girls to distract me. There was no friends. There was nothing. So I was going a bit crazy at my mom's. So I decided to go to this music festival. And it had been 7 years since I had done any partying or anything, right? So I go to this festival and a few people ask me the story. I tell the story and it came up that I was using these painkillers. And everyone seemed really interested in these painkillers. Like, not anymore. And I'm thinking, what's the big deal about the painkillers? So I'd actually gotten off the painkillers, but it was all these people that were asking about it that made me curious. So I decided to go back after and try it just like as a drug. Like, what if I just take this recreationally? What would it be like? And that led to me really liking that. It felt really good. And so I started taking these painkillers daily and started taking more and more. And then I went back and I told the doctor, kind of fudged my story because I'd already been off them. I didn't need them, but I got another prescription for them and started taking more and more and more. So it started with, you're supposed to take one a day. And the last day I took 14 in one day, and I went out and I was at the bar and I'm drinking alcohol. Like I went off the rails and I lost my sobriety. And
oh my gosh.
I just felt like a rock star. I felt so good, but all my friends kept saying, is there something wrong with you? You seem off. Because I wouldn't talk, but I was just floating in the clouds. And then I was still holding down a job. And so I'd go work all day, and all day I'd be thinking about this painkiller. So the second I got home, I'd run back to my room and I'd take a bunch of these pills, and then I'd feel good. And then when I went to work, I started snapping on people, and I realized, like, this isn't me. I'm not the guy who starts yelling at people. What is going on? I need to get off. This stuff's getting a hold of me. So I called my work. I told them what happened. I locked myself in the room and basically detoxed for about 3 weeks of just absolute pain and just rolling around in discomfort, and managed to get off of them. So that was good. But I was still in a lot of pain. So I started jumping from relationship to relationship and using women as a bit of a distraction from my pain, because it was helping me just be like, oh, this feels good. This gets me out of my pain. But it didn't sit right with me. Like, deep down, I knew it was wrong, but I just ignored it and I continued to do it. And this whole time I had had this dream of rock climbing. But when I broke my neck, I realized that I just about lost all hope of having my dream of going overseas. And I had seen this picture of these guys climbing these cliffs in Thailand, like over the ocean. And I wanted to be that guy. And I thought, man, I almost missed my dream here. So I'm going to do this anyway. So I kept going back to the gym and trying to climb, and it was like way too much pain in my neck. So I'd wait another few weeks. I tried again. And then one day I could climb with bearable amounts of pain. So I thought, that's it. I called my work. I said, I need some time off. I need a month off. And I went to Thailand and I started rock climbing outside. And that was the first time up to that point I was climbing inside, just training. And then I went outside. I learned how to climb outside in Thailand. And the time came to return to work, but I didn't. All of a sudden, I had to experience this freedom of, what happens if I'm not just working and trying to make ends meet? What if I'm like living for me? What if I'm doing something that I want to do? And this felt so good. So I decided I didn't want to go back to work. So I called and told them I needed more time. They weren't okay with that. So I told them I quit. And I stayed in Thailand for 3 months and just rock climbed. Ended up coming back to help my parents wire their house they were building. My brother was getting married, so I decided I'd only come back for a month, do these things, and then I'd go back to Thailand. Came back. I had this very expensive rent because I was living in Vancouver, BC during the big Olympics. So there was this major building boom. I was fixing the tower cranes. There was like 100 tower cranes all over Vancouver, and I was one of 7 electricians that could fix them. So I was climbing these like 300 foot cranes, like every day, working up like 300 feet above the air and doing all the electrics on it, fixing them, getting them moving. And because I was making pretty good money, I had this high end apartment and all this. But when I came back, I didn't want to return to work. So I subletted the apartment and I bought a Volkswagen Westphalia and I moved into the van. And this was a way that I cut my expenses to zero. And I went, attended the wedding, helped my mom wire the house. And then I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, but I actually really loved the simplicity of living in the van. And my work was still asking me to come back, but I said, no, I'm not going to. So I headed south. The winter was hitting in Canada, and I just crossed the border and started going to all these climbing destinations. It was amazing. I spent 9 months traveling through the U.S. and just meeting all these rock climbers that were living in their vans and traveling around. And it was some of the best months of my life. Like, I just really, really enjoyed the freedom and being outside and in touch with nature and all that, and made it all the way down into just above Monterrey into El Potrero Chico, climbing in Mexico. And van broke down there. I've stuck there for a while, whatever. Managed to get it fixed, managed to get back to Canada. And still living in the van, was really liking this life of just no responsibility, very selfish, started going to music festivals. And because I had that experience with started taking the morphine or whatever, I also just started getting back into the music festival, and guys were saying like, oh yeah, we've all had our troubles with drugs. It's not a big deal. You just have to approach it more responsibly, take it every now and then. And so I got back into taking psychedelics, but just with intention this time. My intention was to like, how do I heal my pain? How do I get over all this trauma? And so I would take it with intent.
And that was years after you had already been basically shown by God that you were an addict.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow. What a testimony to the deception of our own heart and how it can absolutely cause our sinful nature to sabotage God's efforts in our lives. That's crazy.
Exactly. And I love this saying that just this once is the tip of the wedge that splits the log. So it seems all like, oh, it's
that
just,
is powerful.
Right. And then bam. So here I was, the psychedelics, the drugs like creep back into my life. I have a pretty good hold on them because I'm aware of the addiction. So I don't do it daily. It's once every few months, every 6 months, maybe. So there I am. That kind of creeps back in. I run out of money because I'm living in this van. I'm climbing all over. I'm going to festivals and I spend all my savings. I spent about $70,000 just living in this van, but I'm 3 years in and I lived for 3 years without working and lived pretty cheap. And then it came back, okay, I'm out of money. I have to go back to work, but I didn't want to go back to work. So I decided to sell my house and it was right after the crash of 08. So things had come down and I'd also been studying money along since I was 20. And so I sold the house. I went into gold and silver with a lot of that money. And then I continued to go on for about another year, just traveling around, whatever. And then I wanted to get back into work because idle hands, what do they say? What's the thing about idle hands? Like the devil is the devil's playhouse or whatever.
Devil's plaything. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's exactly what happened. The devil started to make his way more and more into my life and I could feel it. I could feel that I wasn't doing anything with my life. It felt very stagnant. I really felt discontent and I needed to get things moving. So it took me about a year to get back into work. It was really hard when people see a big gap in your resume, like, oh, what did you do for the last 3 years? Where did you go? But I managed to get a job working for the health authority, doing the electrical on a bunch of smaller hospitals. So I moved out into this little hippie town out in the mountains in British Columbia. Just before I moved out, I was still climbing. I managed to get back into climbing. And I was climbing this really hard climb with my girlfriend at the time. And I was up about 30 feet and an accident happened and I fell and there was too much rope out and I hit the ground. I landed on the rock from 27 feet. My feet wrapped. And just, I landed on this ramp and both feet just, you know, severed like all the ligaments in my ankles. Screaming. I thought I had shattered everything. I was carried out. They took me to the hospital. Here's some Canada healthcare for you guys again. They say, what hurts the most? They say, my feet. And they say, which one? I said, my right foot. So they x-ray 1 foot and they said, oh, it's not broken. You're fine. It's probably going to be a year or more of pain, but you'll be okay. And they discharged me and that's all they did.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, no, I meant the left.
Yeah.
But I'm like, but the left really hurts, you know?
Oh no.
So I go home, I can't walk, and now everything's taken away from me. I don't have climbing. The woman I'm with, we break up because she made the mistake. She had all this rope out. So that led to some friction between us. I had also been getting into yoga to help me with my pain. It was helping a bit, but it got to the point I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't walk, so I would get around by riding a bike. I was so gibbled, and then I'd get off the bike, and I'd just hobble over to the nearest thing I could lean on, and I would lean on it. And it was like this for a couple of years. That's when there was this new level of pain that was just unbearable. My other best friend that I was very close with dies of a drug overdose. And so that was another thing, just like, bam, bam, like slap, slap, like just one thing after another. It felt like every time my life would get into a better place, something else traumatic would happen.
I just want to know when you sell the movie rights on this, because this is, I mean, this is unreal. I've never heard a story like this where somebody has suffered so much physically and emotionally. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I don't know. It really humbles you. And the whole time, like I look like I'm in pretty good shape. Like I don't have any extra weight. I have some muscle mass. And so people are like, oh, you look healthy. You must be fine. And I'm going, man, I'm suffering. I'm suffering deeply. And so that really led me to understand that when I look in another man's eyes in the street, I have no idea what that man has been through or is going through. And so it led me to have this like really deep, deep compassion for others and just this understanding that I have no idea what somebody else is going through. So it really started to open my heart which was one of the major blessings that came from this.
So when were you reintroduced to God? When did God make his presence known again, recapture your heart? What did that look like?
Yeah. So then I was running from all of this again. So I move out to this hippie mountain town. I get a job, but I'm in a lot of pain. Then I have something happen. I come home at Christmas one year. I have a cousin who's like on the street from addiction. They release her picture in the paper. She's all looking like she's 38 at the time or something, or 36, but she's addicted to heroin. So it just looks like it was heartbreaking, put it that way. And it got the family into a bit of an argument. They released this on Christmas Day. They released this picture of her, and it just tore our family apart. I'm really worried about her. I'm like, we need to go find her. And so I get in a fight with my brother. My brother's saying I'm ruining his Christmas because like they just want to pretend it's not happening.
Right.
And so my brother and I get in a fight. We hadn't been physical since we were young. Hmm. And so we're not swinging, but we wrestled to the ground. Hmm. And my mom's husband, I don't even want to call him my stepdad because I don't really like the fella. Hmm. He's about 300 and some odd pounds, 6'4", just a massive guy. My mom's screaming. He comes over, he rips me off, and he just starts pounding.
Oh my gosh.
And I got beat up really, really bad. And because of my neck fusion, it pinched a nerve in my neck and I couldn't lift my arm. So I go back to the mountain town. I'm suffering. I can't sleep. My chronic pain just goes through the roof. Everything hurts. My feet still hurt. Every morning I get up, I can barely walk. It's just the neck, 4 hours of sleep, my shoulder, my hip, my back, everything. So all of a sudden I realize I can't rock climb anymore. It's getting desperate. And so I lose all my friends. My climbing friends were like, what was my community?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I felt like that's like a culture. When you enter that climbing thing, it is a culture. I have a buddy who's a skydiver and it's very similar. There's a whole culture around skydiving, rock climbing, a lot of these things. And yeah, if you stop, you're not in touch with them anymore.
That's right. And I thought these guys were good friends and they knew about my injuries and that. And then as soon as I realized I couldn't climb with them anymore, they just stopped calling me. And so that really hurt. And so I'm sitting at home. I have no friends. I'm in pain. I'm suffering. My relationships keep failing. I got into these relationships with mentally ill women. That was like, it was just like, what is going on here? I was still using psychedelics occasionally, but it became more and more like I would only use them with really strong intent now. It was like, I would take them alone. I'd take high doses and I would be like, the intent is to figure out what is the root of all my pain? How do I get past this? Right. And so I started using ayahuasca. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but it's the most hallucinogenic drug there is. The psychedelic component of that is dimethyltryptamine. They mix it with a bark root, a very specific bark root that makes it so you don't metabolize the DMT right away. So it extends the experience to about a 6 hour, 8 hour journey. And it's just highly, highly hallucinogenic. Wow. So you go on these journeys and you have these visions, and it's called the spirit molecule, DMT, because when I started taking DMT, it's undeniable that it is something that comes from God, because it's actually released in our body naturally two times, the moment we're born and the moment we die. We have DMT within us, and it's naturally released in those moments. And it's released in the mother when she gives birth. So it's very tied to birth and death. And when you take this, the visions that I've experienced, what I saw, I was like, no man could paint this. No man could create something this beautiful. This has to be from God. And so it's interesting that it's called the spirit molecule. And I start using this ayahuasca, and I'm going deep, going deep. And so I'm told that I have 1 year to live. I'm told that I'm going to die. And I believe it. I come out of this and I'm thinking, I have to tell my family. I'm going to have to break their hearts. I have to tell my girlfriend, like everything I've done up to this point, like all my visions are about to die. Like I have to prepare for death. And I'm heartbroken. I'm in tears. I'm shattered. And I come out, and the next day or two, I start to think, oh, maybe this was just a vision. It doesn't have to necessarily be true. Like, why am I believing this so much? It is just a drug. And so the interesting thing is my life ends up just falling apart in this city. It's all, I won't get into what happened, but all of a sudden my business collapses. Mm. I break up. I decide I have to move home because I'm watching the markets and I'm thinking something's not right here. Something big is coming and I need to be closer to family. And all of the time I started.
What year was this?
This was about a year before COVID.
Okay.
Hit. And I started feeling God come into my life. And I started thinking, I need to start exploring Christianity. But where I was living, because it's so hippie and radically feminist, that little town, very few people were open to Christianity. And I didn't even feel like I could talk about it. So it was my own personal journey that I was starting to open my mind to. But I was not ashamed of it or anything, but I didn't want to make it public because I didn't want to be judged or whatever. So everything falls apart, watching markets, thinking something big's coming. I move back home. I land at my parents' house and I'm planning to just get my own place and all that. But I'm like, oh, I'll just live in their suite for a month or two while I get my feet on the ground here. But I have this inclination that something big is happening, right? So I start stockpiling food. And my stepdad's going like, what are you doing? Sure, you can stockpile food in the closet, but I don't know why or anything. 3 weeks after that, when I complete the pantry, the pandemic happens and the panic and everyone, there's shortages of everything. And I'm fully stocked and I'm going, hey, intuition checks out. I was right. And wow. I was all relaxed. I didn't even go out. So now I'm living back home. I don't have business. I don't have any friends. I don't have any community. And then the lockdowns start to happen. I'm approaching 40 years old. Mm. I'm single. I don't have God. I don't have anything. And I'm living in my parents' basement again. Yeah. I'm going, this is like the exact place you do not want to be. And I have failed. Whatever I've done did not work. And I went through this really, this terrible dark night of the soul. I just entered this really deep, deep depression. I still had the chronic pain and all these other things. And I'm thinking, I messed up my life. There's not really hope for me. And so I start to contemplate suicide, actually. I had this rifle and the bullets are right there. Maybe I should just do it. I just don't think I can go on. The pain is too much. If this pain doesn't stop, I can't go on. There's no point. It's too much. And these dark thoughts are running through my head and I'm fighting them. But at the same time, I'm sitting with it because I just decided to take a radical approach. So I quit all substance, didn't drink, didn't smoke weed, quit all of that, quit social media. And I just was like, I'm just going to face this thing head on, like bring it, show me, just give me all you got. Mm. Give me all the pain. So I sat in meditation every day and just really looked at it like, what's the truth of this? The truth is that I did mess up my life. Mm. I did make some big mistakes. I have been living in sin. Let's not run from that. Let's admit that I messed up, right? Mm. And let's admit that whatever I'm doing, my approach is not working. So I just sat with that and I was familiar with kind of meditation and sitting and psychedelics and stuff. So I admit that whatever I'm doing isn't working. And I tried everything. I tried all these like different modalities, psychedelics, practitioners. I'd spent $20,000 on all this money trying to get out of my pain, chiropractors, IMS, all the things, right? Massage therapy, physio, nothing even touched it. Nothing would even remotely remove any pain. So I was desperate. So I decide to try something radically different, something I had never tried. The last place I ever expected to look, I just decided to start praying every single day because I had all this time and what else are you going to do? So I'm like, it can't hurt. So I start praying 2 to 3 hours a day, just sitting in prayer and not like the loosey goosey kind of like, oh, I'm just going to meditate and try and manifest. That was my old approach. This new approach was like, Lord Jesus, I'm praying directly to you. I need your help. I'm desperate. Please, Lord, please help me. I need you more than ever. I have failed, and just turning it all over to God. And I prayed for two very specific things. I prayed to get out of my pain. because if I couldn't get out of the pain, I couldn't go on. And I prayed that I would meet my wife, something else that had also eluded me for the past 20 years. Mm. And both these things came to me in 6 months. All of my pain, I'm not talking one little part of pain, all of it just disappeared. And I met my wife, the most perfect, amazing wife you could ever imagine, way beyond all of my dreams, all of my expectations.
Wow.
Both these things came to me within 6 months. And this is coming from, I did believe in Jesus, but I didn't follow Jesus. I was like, I think Jesus was a real man, but I didn't identify as Christianity. I didn't read the gospel. I didn't look into it. That's as far as it went. So after this happened, I'm like, I think I've been lied to, just like everything else, just like the financial system, just like the medical system. Maybe I've been lied to all this time about Christianity. Maybe there's something to it. So I start I open the gospel. I start reading the word. And this is like, I don't go to church or anything. I'm just like on my own time from my own approach, just start reading his word. And I'm thinking, why didn't I do this earlier? Look at all of this. This is pure gold. All my life, I've been searching for a male mentor to guide me. Yeah. Like my father, like two stepdads, both failed me. My real father failed me. All the men in trades I reached out to failed me. All the idols I had placed, money, women, climbing, all of that, it all failed me. And then you start reading the word and it's like, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. This is calling me to a higher calling. It's pushing me to strive to be more Christ-like, to be a better man. Here's a set of concrete values that you can take and you can apply to your life that are going to serve you. And I just thought, man, all these years, I just didn't even think to open a Bible or to turn to Christ. And my heart was changed. So I just started reading every piece of Christian content I could find and reading the word and seeking out a church. And my wife also was raised radically Christian. They actually were homeschooled. They lived in community and all that. So she had her own thing where she turned away from that. And she was seeking in things like yoga and different things like that. But she also came full circle. So we were both just returning to Christ together. And so we've had this shared journey since we met. I proposed within 7 weeks. We were married within a year. and now she's pregnant and we're expecting. And it's just like my life just radically turned around. And now we've found an amazing church. They do all these men's only meetups and linked up with just brotherhoods of Christian men, and just feeling the power of that, like men meeting together with intention, with God at the highest level of that, with God as the reason we're meeting, God above all else, and praying for one another and helping one another. And that's been the blessing with all of this, with all of my suffering, with all the lockdowns and COVID. I was happy when that happened because I was already in this like introspective, all alone thing and feeling like Christ come into my life. So that's been the blessing really of all of this. When I was told by taking those psychedelics and the whatever the mother Aya, the spirit of that plant medicine told me that I would die, I did die.
Yeah.
The old me died. It was 100%. And it was exactly within a year. That whole year was just a big fall. Like everything imploded. The old me died completely. And I stepped into this, like I had no ego. It was the weirdest thing. I was very quiet. It's the strangest thing to have the death of ego. You're not proud of yourself. You're not, you have nothing going. You don't identify with anything. And it's just this blank slate. And to have Christ come in and form this new foundation built on solid rocks, like built on truth, where before everything was on shaky ground. And now I know anything can be taken from me. My money, I've lost insane amounts of money. I've lost the partners. I've lost my false idols. I've lost all these things. All these worldly things can be taken from you, but your connection with Christ is something that cannot be taken from you. And now I know and I feel that I have this solid foundation to start building on. And I choose the bricks, and I only place bricks that are truthful. And so I look at every brick I take to start building upon. I make sure that it's a brick of truth. I use my discernment to make sure that if I'm going to bring this into my life now, it's going to be in harmony with God, with Christ, with truth, with divinity. So that's a bit of my journey in a nutshell. Yeah.
Wow, Chris, this is the longest fence post story I think we've had on the show.
But it was worth it every really minute, though. Was.
It's an incredible story.
Hopefully that's
no, what it was good.
Dude, it was...
You matted it down or whatever.
I was on the edge of my seat.
I don't think so.
Yeah, not a downer at all.
Yeah. So, Cody, what's happened with your half-brother and your mom and other members of your family? Because you were always estranged from them to some degree, right? And then it all came to a bad place a couple years ago. What's happened since you've discovered your faith in Christ and now you have a wife and a kid on the way? Have you had some reconciliation with your family members?
Yeah, so I've always been really close with my mother.
Okay.
And now I'm realizing, like, too close in the sense of when you don't have a father, it's all on the mother. And so I'm just opening now to realizing it's a very important thing that men do to sever the mother connection at one point. So
that's right. Yeah.
It's just now
which
that
is
I'm
not easy.
No, it isn't. Now I'm just feeling really repelled by her in a way. I love my mother. Mm. She's great. But it's just like, I need a clean separation. I'm in marriage now. I have my wife. I need to focus. I have my own life. So things were always good with my mother. It's in an interesting spot because I'm distancing myself from her now. But it's interesting because she started coming to church with me and my wife. Good. I'm hoping that, yeah, so she has faith. She's doing a lot of reading. It's really helping her faith along. My brother is not open to it at all. He doesn't talk to me. We don't really talk. And that's his thing. That's not me. That's his own. I try and reach out, but he's not really open to it. So,
does he see a change in you, though? I mean, he's not open to it right now, at least, but does he recognize that you're different now?
It's hard to say because I think he's running. So I think he almost doesn't want to see me because he senses that things are going well for me. And I think that shines a light on where he's at. I think he probably does, but that's just kind of me guessing. I don't know for sure. He tends to just avoid me.
And you said your mom had always been open to Christianity, but just kind of loose with it, right? So are you seeing changes in her now that she's coming to church with you and your wife?
Yeah. Yeah, I am. She's in a tricky place with her husband, because they're realizing, like, I've known this for many years, but she was blind to it, that they're actually not in love. He has no faith. He's an alcoholic.
Wow.
He's all on board with these mandates and everything that's going on. And she's not. She lost her job because of it. And she's doubling down on her faith. And he's going the other direction. He's like, I'm committed to this alcohol. That's my thing. So it's good for her. I see that it's giving her strength. She's going to have her own process. She's going to have to come to terms to realize whatever's going on with her and her husband and all that. So I'm glad she's coming to church to really help fill her up, because I can't be her rock anymore. I'm my wife's rock now. And it's like,
right.
So she feels a bit abandoned, I think, but I'm glad that she's coming to church and she has Christ in her life, because that's what's going to fill her up and give her the courage to do whatever needs to happen.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about trauma on this show. In other episodes, we've talked to counselors, licensed counselors, and others. Part of the discussion has been how most men really don't even recognize the trauma they've been through, much less get treatment for it.
100%.
And you talked a lot about your physical trauma, which I think each of us can identify with. To an extent.
I don't know if I can identify with
that. Well, I've torn the ligaments in one of my ankles. Nothing with my neck. What you didn't talk as much about when telling your story was the emotional trauma that you've been through. I mean, you touched on different events that obviously had a big impact, but you tended to talk more about your physical pain.
Right.
So when you say that Jesus healed you of your pain, can you talk a little bit about your emotional pain that you've been through and, and what healing you've gotten there?
Oh, profound. The emotional pain and trauma that I suffered was just as much or even more so than the physical. Mm-hmm. It's just that people don't see it. But that's what gets you. Mm-hmm. If your mind, if your soul, if your spirits are not in a good place, that's when you start contemplating maybe taking your own life or something. So I was really suffering there. I'm running from all this pain, and there's certain ways I'm doing that. One was getting involved in relationships because that was a distraction and it was fun and whatever it was. So I was getting involved in relationships when I shouldn't have been for the wrong reasons. And once I started opening to that truth, all of a sudden I had this unbearable shame that I had been untruthful. It wasn't like I was getting into these relationships because I genuinely love the woman. It was because it was helping me escape my pain. So I was getting into it for the wrong reasons. And I was misleading these women. And so I felt so much shame for that. Because it's one thing to cause your own pain. It's like, okay, I suffer. That's okay. I'm paying the consequence. But when you hurt somebody else, that really lands heavy on my heart. And I was carrying all this shame for how I had hurt others. That was a big thing. I thought, I will never be able to forgive myself. How do I make amends? How do I let go of this? How do I move past it? And I thought, there's no way I can do it. I've done too much pain. And looking back, it's like, I was inflating it a bit because I think we're really hard on ourselves. So I was inflating it, thinking I was the worst person in the world, but it's like, I wasn't murdering people, but in my mind, it was huge. I had hurt a lot of people. I never thought I could be forgiven. And so that was a thing that I prayed for. And it was interesting because when Christ came into my life, it was the first time in my life that I was able to, let me put it this way. So I was always playing the victim. I always thought, man, I've had it rough. Why can't people see this? Guys, I'm suffering. Look how much I've been through. Give me some credit here. And I couldn't get any credit or no one would notice. And so my heart was heavy with that. But I came to this realization that, hey, I'm the only person that knows what I've been through start to finish. So I'm the only person who knows and who can love myself and give myself credit for getting through those things. So when Christ came into my life, it was the first time I was able to look in the mirror and genuinely say, brother, I love you. I truly love you. I recognize you. I see you. I know what you've been through and I love you. And that, yeah. So this self-love.
Cause then it wasn't just you, it's God. Like you said, you were the only one that could see, but the only other one that can see is God, who's been with you the whole time. So I love that you went to that place, because one of the things that stood out to me about your story was God's mercy, and grace. Oh, you could have ended up committing suicide yourself. You could have ended up dead from the fall or who knows how many other situations, the neck break. And God, man, did he. Wow. He had so much mercy to bring you to this place now where he gets to be your all-sufficient one, your all-sufficient father, loving, gracious father.
No, exactly. And looking back, I realized he's been there all along. It's just, I was so stubborn and so selfish and so committed to sin that level of suffering is what it took for Christ to open my heart to him. And so I'm so grateful for every single moment, all that suffering. I would do it all again if it led me to Christ. And so another thing is when I opened to that and when Christ came into my life, it was unreal. That shame, I didn't even pray for it, actually. It just disappeared. It just melted. And I don't carry shame. I recognize that I've made mistakes in the past, but I don't carry that shame anymore, you know, and it's unreal that just God's grace and mercy, like you said. Yeah.
Well, man, what an inspiration. Gosh, Cody, this has been amazing, amazing to hear from you. And I know, man, do I know guys are loving this and encouraged by God's faithfulness. And hopefully, even if it's not to the extreme that you went through, that they can see some of their own life in your story and God's faithfulness to them as reflected in your story. Hey guys, that's all the time we have left for this first half of our interview with Cody Thompson. We'll have the second half available this Friday, so make sure you check that out. And thank you so much for joining us. Please let us know if you have any questions. Reach out to me at mhatch@clchq.org. We'd love to hear from you.